The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Head over to sewersofparis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon to join the folks who make the show possible. Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. The topic this week is Tales of the City, Cruising, and Being a Ballet Dancer. What kind of gay are you, and how many different kinds of gay have you been? My guest this week is Michael, a San Francisco library gay who's also been a ballet gay, a nightclub gay, a rowing gay, and various other flavors with probably more to come. Michael grew up around queer people, with progressive parents and a childhood passion for dancing in the Pennsylvania Ballet, where he had some moments of personal awakenings involving dancers in sailor costumes. But he still wasn't sure who he was, and so after coming out in college, he fled to the West Coast to reinvent himself in Harvey Milk's neighborhood. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a big thanks to everyone who makes the Sewers of Paris possible with a pledge of support on Patreon. Head over to sewersofparis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon to check out the rewards for backers. And just a reminder that the Sewers of Paris is on Twitter and Facebook. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode. And I hope you'll join me for our next fun-friendly live stream on January 25. It's a laid-back brunchtime chat about the books and movies and music and shows that are bringing you joy right now. There's a link at the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. And by the way, if you like LGBTQ podcasts, you may enjoy my other show, Queens of Adventure, a comedy adventure podcast that stars drag queens playing Dungeons and Dragons. That's at queensofadventure.com. Now, here's Michael. Well, this week I'm speaking with Michael Vincent Danella Mercanti. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's an honor.
So, what is the entertainment that changed your life?
I've thought a lot about it. I think it has to do with live theater and entertainment.
Great.
It was really growing up in Philadelphia. You're kind of close to New York, and there's a lot of great theater around. And my parents always brought us to theater, and we were always involved in theater. And that just, it was something so cool.
Were there, like, particular shows that you, like, stick with you? Or, like, you're like, oh, I got to see that again and again and again.
I think it's a lot of things that just stuck with me. The theater that, like, the Pennsylvania Ballet would put on, they had their seasons and we would see every show that they would put on. We'd see, my father would take me to operas that were at the Academy of Music, but also at, like, in basements of churches. And, like, lots of every musical that was in town. I don't know how we did it, but I think, like, a family friend or something would always get us tickets. Well, I just read When Brooklyn Was Queer. And to speak of things that had very intense influences on my life, the idea of sailors just really impacted me as a kid. For very queer reasons. But the one ballet, Fancy Free, which is like a group of sailors just on leave in New York City, hanging out, really stuck with me for a long time.
Okay. Describe that, because I'm not familiar with that one.
So it's a group of sailors, and I remember it differently than it might actually be, but I just remember three really handsome men on stage dancing around, and one man in particular who was kind of the barkeeper, and he was wiping the table and hanging out. I was obsessed with it, and I would look online and read about sailors and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
It's very, very gay.
Well, yeah, I mean, are we talking like those like high-waisted pants with like the bell bottoms is like, oh, what's the there was a Coen Brothers movie that had a dance number like that. Now I can't remember the name of it.
Oh no. Yeah, something probably evoking that same ballet.
Okay.
Cuz it was when I was a kid, very involved in ballet. So I was always around queer people in that kind of world as a dancer, but to see these like beautiful men it was really cool.
So what was your involvement in ballet? Like, were you actually performing?
Oh yeah. So when I was a kid, my parents put us into dance class as our activity. So I think every day after school from like first grade, like through middle school, I was in Philadelphia. We lived in New Jersey, but I was in Philadelphia training.
Was that, you said your parents put you in, like, was it something that you were like, oh God, I have to do this? Or were you like, I love it?
Oh no, my sisters felt like they had to do it, but I was definitely the most enthusiastic.
Well, what sticks with you from that? Like, how long did that go? And like, were there particular shows that you really enjoyed doing?
I don't know. Well, the Nutcracker every year. I actually, to go back to the now that I think about it, to go back to the sailor theme, I wore the sailor costume in the Pennsylvania Ballet Nutcracker, and very, very intense. And then after the performances, you were allowed to ask for like a ballet slipper from one of the dancers.
Oh.
Yeah. And I have this prized possession. I think I still have it in like my, with my stuff at my parents' house, but it's this ballet shoe from this dancer I was just so into. He was so cool.
What do you remember, like, his name or like what was his deal?
Oh no, he kind of had like the most beautiful blonde hair and the coolest signature. He gave me a white ballet slipper and he came up to me and like shook my hand in a really professional way. It was kind of fun, you know.
How old were you?
Maybe like fifth grade.
Okay.
Yeah.
What, like, when you were up on stage and you were, like, performing, or just, like, in rehearsals, like, what was it about that you looked forward to? Like, how does it feel to be in a ballet?
I don't know. It you get to use your body in a lot of really cool and exciting ways. I think I stopped dancing when I got to high school to focus on sports, but it really is this really fun, I think any way you're using your body and exerting, kind of working your body to its physical extreme is something that I really enjoy doing.
What was it about, like, you know, ballet versus, I don't know, like cross-country running or sports that you did later? Like, what made that different from some other intense physical activity?
I don't know. It was something that spoke to me, like emoting through your body.
What kind of, like, you know, someone who's very unfamiliar with ballet and, like, I'm super not knowledgeable here. When you say emoting through your body, like, were there things that you were getting out or, like, things, emotions that you wanted to get across that was, like, a relief to have ballet as a way to do that?
Probably. I'd say, yeah. I think it comes to this intersection of what, I'd say the intersection between things I did because my family did them or my parents wanted me to do them versus things I did because I enjoyed them. I think ballet kind of hit right in the center of that.
Sure. So it's something you want to do and your family wanted you to do. So it's hitting two things at the same time?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think I'm articulating myself quite as well. It kind of, I mean, there's other, I should say we're focusing a lot on ballet, but there's other media that very much changed me and really made me gay.
Well, let's talk about that, because I mean, I imagine like the beautiful blonde sailor probably had an effect, but like what else was in the mix that made you be like, I don't know, it was like when you knew.
When I knew, yeah, that meme has been so good lately. I loved like musicals growing up. I just read When Brooklyn, I'm thinking a lot about the sailors because I just read When Brooklyn Was Queer, and the entire thing is about, one, hot sailors, and two, all these people who were queer and were creating this media that I didn't know. Like, Gypsy Rose Lee's, like, I loved the musical Gypsy growing up. I just was obsessed. Listened to it on repeat constantly. This was the Bernadette Peters Gypsy. I was not young enough to be obsessed with the Patti LuPone Gypsy. I would probably be a very different person if Patti LuPone were my Broadway diva, but Bernadette Peters, I'm a Bernadette Peters gay through and through. And reading that book, reading When Brooklyn Was Queer, and finding out that she was queer and kind of made her daughter, Gypsy Rose Lee, buy her houses in Manhattan, where she would stay with all of her other queer women that were her friends, and Gypsy Rose Lee had to get a house in Brooklyn with W.H. Auden because she wanted to be away from her mother. Just mm-hmm. Those kind of, like, of course I was drawn to this character. She's queer, but it's never mentioned in the musical.
Yeah, there's just, I guess, you could totally miss it, but there certainly is a, I don't know, a flavor to that character, no matter who plays her.
Yeah, no wonder the marriage didn't work out, you know?
Yeah. What was the, like, your awareness of queerness when you were growing up? Was it something that you thought of as something that you owned, or, like, did that come later?
I don't know. I was always around queer people. I have an older cousin who is, like, 40, and my mother, like, raised him. She calls him her first gay son. So I've always had him. His boyfriends were always around. My uncles. The queer people I danced with. Like, I always knew what queerness was, what gayness was.
Well, so what was your feeling about how it applied to you?
I don't know. How it applied to me. I definitely knew I was gay mm-hmm. for a very long time.
Do you remember a time when you were struggling with that? But it seems like there's a lot of gays around you, so maybe it just was never a struggle.
Yeah, I definitely had the language. Growing up, coming to San Francisco especially, and hearing stories of other guys who didn't have the language to articulate their desires. Like, my mother would always say, you know, whoever you bring home, whether it be a Prince Charming or a princess, like, that was always there. But I definitely was, I mean, don't get me wrong, I was very repressed in my, like, self-afflicted oppression was definitely a thing. I didn't come out till I had a boyfriend, and that was definitely in college.
What was going on there that, like, you had so many folks around you? Like, what did you think would happen if you did come out?
I don't know. I think about that kind of heteronormative safety that I clinged to back then. Mm-hmm. And the idea of being very assimilationist. I mean, it goes back to the decision I made, like, freshman year of high school, deciding to pursue rowing and a sport, like being a varsity athlete, instead of being, like, a queer ballet dancer. And that was, I don't know, I felt that pressure, maybe growing up in a small town, maybe, like, definitely it was the environment outside of the home. Both my parents are artists, so the pressure came from, society, mm-hmm. not as much from the culture that was around me, but the culture I saw every day at, like, say, at school.
Yeah, so you said you got into rowing, like, you left the ballet to do rowing, and was that just something that, like, well, all the other guys are doing this, so I guess I have to?
Kind of. My parents had a friend who was the coach, so they made me do a summer program, and then that became longer, and then that became the whole summer, and then that became fall. I really fell into it, how it came about.
Was there anything, maybe this is a reach, but your interest in sailor aesthetic, like, did that perhaps lure you closer to the rowing?
Matt, my mind is blown. Of course, probably. Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm definitely, I'm pretty transparent.
We all are. So you had an opportunity to be nautical.
Yes, and I was very sexy doing it.
Well, sure, like, that's quite a workout, but, like, a different kind of workout and a different kind of uniform. Like, in the same way that ballet has a uniform, I assume so does, like, whatever sports you're doing.
Yeah, you got to wear, like, a very tight uni suit that was clung to all the right places.
Mm-hmm. Did you miss the ballet when you left?
Yeah, I definitely did. I definitely pursued it a little bit in college, and I still, like, go to dance class every once in a while. But it, yeah, I definitely miss it. But I'm so happy I have that kind of core knowledge of the ballet. It's such a cool world with amazing, talented people. And they're, like, it's something I definitely didn't, looking back, I don't think I could have been, I could have pursued it with the intensity that other people who succeeded with it do. But yeah, I'm happy. I'm so happy I had that kind of knowledge growing up.
Then you said that college, it sounds like that was a time of big changes, because, you know, you had the ballet for a little while, you had the rowing for a while, and then you went to college. That was when you came out, you had a boyfriend. Mm-hmm. Where did you go to college, and what was your, you know, what trajectory did you expect when you went in?
Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey, on the banks of the old Raritan. great school. I didn't really have anything, because I turned down my recruitment opportunities at other schools. Rutgers rowing program wasn't Division I, so I wasn't really interested. I was kind of just ready for experiences. I started playing rugby when I was at school. I started writing for a satirical newspaper, which was really fun. And yeah, I kind of just tried to be like without one of those intense passions. It was kind of the first time in my life I didn't have this huge all-consuming activity that I had to do every waking moment that I wasn't in school.
Gosh, did that that must have been quite a shift. Like, did you like that, or was it stressful to not have something filling all your time?
There's a lot of time.
Sure.
Like, when every waking moment is not consumed, like, I would, like, go to practice and then, like, run and try to do, like, two workouts a day for a long time. Plus the summers. Every summer of my high school was filled out with, like, amazing. They were great times. Like, we were traveling to Tennessee and Canada and all over the country, and really cool experiences. But yeah, when you don't have an activity to cling your identity to, it's kind of fun exploring other ways to have an identity.
What were some of the ways that you explored having an identity? Like, what did you try out?
I tried rugby. That was very, very masculine. Lots of guys who voted for Trump. I didn't realize it at the time, you know? I didn't see it. They were, like, very good friends, and now I'm like, oh, yikes. Mm-hmm. I tried doing theater, but I found theater gays quite fun, but not my type of gay. It's kind of in a couple ways. I found a really great group of friends who I still am really great friends with today. But there's a kind of the trend of assimilationism, or the assimilationist trend, like integrating into, I felt like I was always the one gay in the group that I was in, and I would always date the other one gay in another group. Like, I've dated my way through the different frats, the one gays and all the different frats. And then, yeah, I think as much as I changed in college, that it's kind of like a Pete Buttigieg syndrome. Like, I still felt that. It wasn't really until I moved out here to San Francisco that I was in a totally all-queer environment. It's, you know, it's very different.
What do you mean by a Pete Buttigieg syndrome?
Like, putting ambition before, like, being true to yourself. I mean, not to criticize him. He is incredibly accomplished and great. And regardless of how my politics differ from his, the, like, if he wins, I will cry. I have some friends who are very into him, but the way he put his career before his identity is a sacrifice that I think a lot of people who are especially white, especially who can be mass presenting, take for granted. And it's hard. I see traces of myself that I did that when I was much younger. And now I'm like high femme goddess who can't hide my queerness if I tried.
Tell me about, you said it was in college when you had your first boyfriend. So how did that, like, come about? Like, what was the thing that, like, finally pushed you out of the closet?
I met this boy. He was really cute. And I don't know, like, it wasn't my first time being with a guy. That definitely happened in high school a couple times, but I don't know, having someone, it was the first time I was with someone who I didn't want to keep a secret. I kind of thought he was cooler than me. So I kind of wanted everyone to know, like, oh, like I could get it. Like I can pull some really cute guys.
Okay. So there's sort of a status thing.
Yeah. Kind of, which is weird to say, but yeah. And then I don't know. I like told my parents, they were like, chill. They're like, oh yeah, we, you have a boyfriend. Cool.
And then from there, were you just like, okay, I guess this is what I'm doing now. And it just like, it sounds like it just wasn't difficult for you.
Yeah. It didn't really change me. Like, I don't think I think being out was not the difficult part. It was definitely, I think I took a queer theory class, like junior year of college. And it just, I've never been radicalized so quickly to the queer agenda. I was like, oh, wow. Because I think I've never really thought to consider queerness as an identity, like, not queer. I never thought to consider queerness as a community. And it was then where I made that huge shift. It was like a monumental shift in my life, and I've never gone back.
Yeah, it sounds like it might have been the way you're describing, like, dating somebody from this circle and this circle and this circle and this circle, that despite your experience being a kind of a social butterfly, it sounds like you might also have been a little lonely, in that it sounds like your circle was a little transient, or at least you were transient through different circles. Like, I don't know, did you feel like you weren't sticking around long enough to build a community?
Oh, I think it was, I definitely had my group of friends, but I was, like, my newspaper friends, I think, are some of my longest lasting friends. Something I did all through college. But you're still the only queer person. And I think that the loneliness doesn't stem from, like, going from group to group. I don't think I really did that. I think I was more the being in groups where I was the only queer person.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think affected me more.
Well, and then you said moving to San Francisco changed all that, which, you know, it has a way of doing to people.
You know.
So when did that happen, and what got you across the country?
So I graduated college in 2017, and I booked a flight. I'd been working and saving up money, and I took a 2-week bender in Mexico to visit family. And then I stayed on my friend's couch for a month in San Francisco and found a job.
Okay.
Yeah. I really should have done it, find a job, then move to San Francisco. But I just was so excited.
Why were you excited? Like, what was the drive, or what was pulling you to San Francisco?
I don't know. It's where it all started, you know? It's kind of this history. Yeah, there's so much. It's the foundation. It's not like I wasn't queer back in Philadelphia. My mother often jokes, like, oh, you can be gay here. I'm like, yeah, I was gay there. I'm gay everywhere. Always been gay. But the something about being where the history is, like, where so much happened. And, like, it's not only the good times and the queer liberation and the Harvey Milk of it all, but it's where there was so much pain and so much queer history. I think that's another reason why the When Brooklyn Was Queer book affected me. And that new Alex Espinosa book called Cruising, there are these books about the history of queer, the history of queers, and that's, I think, so cool.
Well, there's, you know, sort of an excitement about being a part of something that's been going on for a long time, and, like, finding that, you know, you sit somewhere on a timeline with a lot of other people. And also, you know, it can be easy to romanticize, like, oh, it was so great back then. But, you know, also it was actually very difficult for a
yeah,
lot
yeah.
of reasons.
Yeah, yeah. We live in a great time now.
Yeah, yeah. Not to, like, take it for granted that how good we've got it. But also, you know, I think you can appreciate how good we've got it and also appreciate the sacrifices that were made to get us here.
Definitely.
What was your first San Francisco experience? Maybe not like the first like hour that you spent in San Francisco, but what was the thing that made you feel like, oh, I'm in San Francisco? Like, that's just a reminder that this is where I am now.
Wow. What a question. I think I ran into someone I knew from the East Coast. I'd met someone at Tavern on Camac in Philadelphia, the best gay bar in Philadelphia. And I was just walking down the street and he was there. And I was like, oh, hi. And he was like, oh, it's great to see you. Where do you live? We should hang out. We never hung out. But that kind of being able to say that I was from San Francisco and like, I don't, that really was exhilarating. I think, yeah, I took a trip to Denver to see the eclipse. We like drove up to Wyoming, some college friends, and going there, and when people say where you're from and saying San Francisco, that was so exhilarating to me.
Mm.
Yeah.
And you were just, like, you got there, sounds like not a lot of a plan, but you had a couch to sleep on, and...
Yeah, my best friend was up here, so we had a pretty easy, it was a nice, soft landing.
What part of the city?
He lived in Nob Hill.
Okay.
Right by the famous Nob Hill Theater.
Oh, great.
Which we could see out his window. It was very... It's like very, we're here, we're queer.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, and then I moved to SoMa. That was where my first apartment was.
Okay. Well, I mean, if you're looking for history, that really situates you around institutions, queer institutions.
Oh, yeah. Being in SoMa was, I think I moved Dory Alley weekend of when I first got here. I was staying with him and then I got my apartment and moved in Dory Alley weekend. There was like a group of friends, like I lived right on Folsom Street, and they were kind of urinating on their friend, and I was complete, they like offered to help me move my boxes. It was really sweet, but like I it was, you know, I wasn't now I've seen plenty of people do that, so.
So the first weekend that my partner and I moved to San Francisco, like similarly, we had just graduated.
You lived
from
in San Francisco?
I did, yeah.
Okay,
so
tell me all about it. Tell me all about this.
Okay, so it was, gosh, was it 2002?
Cute.
And we'd both just graduated, and he moved to San Francisco to work in video games, and I was living in Los Angeles to work in entertainment stuff, and it was clear Los Angeles wasn't for me, and he was, you know, up the coast, so I was visiting frequently, and I was like, oh, enough, okay, I have to move to San Francisco. No plan, no job, no apartment. I think I drove up 1 week, looked at apartments with them, found one that I liked, incredibly fortunate, just in like the upper end of the panhandle right by Golden Gate Park.
Oh, and perfect, perfect area.
It was great, yeah. Lone Mountain is the name of the neighborhood. Nobody calls it that, but it was, yeah. So that was the neighborhood. It was by USF. And then, so I found an apartment 1 weekend, then moved up in like with all of my, literally all of my possessions in one station wagon the next weekend. As I was moving in to my new place, that's when I called my landlord in Los Angeles to let him know that I was leaving. So
very responsible. Yeah.
Yeah. That was great. And then, so there I was in San Francisco and I had like the tiniest bit of savings and, I had a client that I was making websites for it out of HTML at the time. And then got a job at a video place that is now, I think, like a luxury mushroom store or something like that.
Oh.
And then, because video stores don't exist, and then, you know, found some corporate jobs and made my way through to blogging, and that was that. But, yeah, you know, I had the same feeling of, oh, this is where the history comes from. I'm a part of this. And there was a time when I like would go to the Castro and be like, wow. And then another time when I go to the Castro and be like, oh, it's too much. Like just finding that calibrating that balance of like, how much gay do I need at a time? And what feels right for me?
Oh yeah. It's everywhere. And it's also the kind of gay that you're looking for. Like sometimes I can't handle the Badlands, like touristy gay moment. And I need to be like in Hole in the Wall, and I need to be at the Eagle. And other times I just need to be at the, like I need to be at the musical night at the Edge, and I just at home, and I know everyone there, and it just feels like a neighborhood. It feels nice.
Mm. Yeah, that's definitely what made me feel like it was where I belonged, is finding that group of people. It was, I don't even know if this exists anymore. Does the Orbit Room still exist?
The Orbit Room?
It was on
room.
Market. Yeah, it was on Market near, I want to say Octavia. And so I would go, I think, every Monday night with a group of gays, and there was a bartender there who would go to the farmer's market on, I think, Sunday, get a whole bunch of fruit, and then just make cocktails out of whatever fruit she had. Alberta was her name.
And beautiful.
It was wonderful. And there were these horrible, horrible tables that were like ice cream cone shaped, and so there was just no good way to sit at. Like, everyone had to sit at the table like with their legs to the side, like side saddle, because you couldn't sit around the table properly. But that was our place, and those were our people.
Exactly. And that's just, oh, that's such a beautiful feeling.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
And how
it's
long
really
did you
nice.
Live here?
2002 to 2011-ish, I think. So
nice.
Basically between the two bubbles. Like, everyone was out of a job when I moved there, and everyone was just starting to get a job again when I left. But it was a lovely time to, because everyone was a little bit freer to be experimental and weird. So there was a lot of like weird happening in San Francisco in that span.
Oh, yes. A lot of people keep saying that the tech people, they've ruined weird San Francisco. But like, I still like will go to this, to the Stud on, which is a collective. I will go to the Stud on a like Wednesday night or something, and there'll be a mixed media art performance about some crazy like performance, dance and singing, and oh, it's, you can still find the weird stuff in San Francisco. There's plenty of it.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because you know, things like the Bridge Theater, which I think probably closed before you got there, but it was like, you know, Peaches Christ would do like midnight screenings of the Bridge, or just around the time that I was leaving, the like little one screen movie theater down the street from me closed down and became retirement housing. So that's really that's a metaphor.
Okay, boomer.
Yeah.
I can't believe, yeah, I've never heard of the, you said the Orbit?
Yeah, the Orbit Room.
Wow, I wish it was here.
What kind of, so I know you, like, you just got there 2 years ago and still kind of like figuring out the city and getting situated, because it can take like a long time to really find your groove. And it sounds like you've got like some solid, waypoints, I guess, or markers to, you know, be like, okay, this is my neighborhood, like the musical night at the Edge or whatever. Are you figuring out, you know, better than you were in college, like, this is the kind of gay I am?
Yeah, I think so. It is it's fun, because I think I've become a lot of different gays since I've moved here. Like, when I was in Soma, I was a very different type of gay. I was at the Stud every weekend till 4 a.m. Like, I was hanging out with, like, a lot of really fun, exciting people. But since I just moved to the Castro, like, a year ago. So I spent a year in Soma and a year in the Castro now. And it's a whole different world. Like, I've gone through, like, I hung out with a group of people who were really religious, but queer, and that was an interesting moment. And then it was like, you know, maybe not for me. But I found all these people, I think, as much as, I mean, Twitter is how I found you. And I think Twitter is such a, like, I moved here, I knew no one except for my friend. And I just logged on and tweeted who wants to hang out, and people were there and ready, and I made those initial friends I made, even though I've explored my identity with all different kinds of friends, but those initial friends I made are still my friends to this day.
I can't imagine how different it is to move to a new city now with Twitter, like, because, you know, that wasn't a thing when I got there. There was blogging, and so we all met each other through Esifist, and, like, that's a big place where I found people.
Esifist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was sort of my community for a while, and, like, comic books, and, you know, I was part of a comic book group, and, yeah, but, like, having the, I don't know, the pleasure of being able to just tweet and be like, hey, so this is the city I'm in, what do I do about it? it sounds like people just, like, really responded to that.
Yeah, they did, and I don't know, I'm immensely grateful of the kindness of strangers. It's, I think it's a uniquely queer experience to trust strangers, and when they're like, oh, come to this house party, and you're like, sure, as I get older, I think back of, like, the risks I've taken, or, like, you know, going to a date's house and meeting them for 5 minutes, but as much as we hear these horror stories, technology brings us together in these unique and, like, beautiful ways.
I'd like to think so. Like, as you know, there's also, like, lots of fights you can have if you want to have fights, but it can be unifying. I guess what is nice is to find the balance of, like, the technology bringing us together, but also, like, the IRL, you know, I'm actually going to go out and see you in person. Of it all.
Yeah, definitely, like, using technology to an IRL like interaction, definitely. Like, I just went to a Gays for Transit happy hour, which was the greatest, the most incredible happy hour I've ever been to in my entire life. It was so cool.
That is really wonderful. I wish that it existed when I was there. There was a really nice thing, and it's, gosh, probably been 10 to 15 years since this was a thing, but for a time, there was sort of, like, in San Francisco, there was this, like, war on fun thing that was happening where, okay, like, you know, I don't know, like, nightlife was getting cracked down on, and street fairs were, like, eliminating, like, you know, drinking in public at the street fair, and, you know, there's a lot of, like, stuff that was, like, just making it hard to have a good time. Like, you had to get a permit to, I don't know, have a weird art car or something like that.
Oh, and is this when they, like, got rid of Castro Halloween?
Oh, God, yes, it was right around that time.
Oh, damn.
I mean, that was, you know, part of that was also that people were getting shot at that, but which wasn't great. But gosh, oh man, Castro Halloween was so good. So there was gay Castro Halloween and there was straight Castro Halloween. And so the gay one was, it happened like a few days before and like locals knew about it. And then on Halloween itself, that's when everybody would come, you know, the Bridge and Tunnel Halloween.
Oh yeah, those Bridge and Tunnel crowd, yeah.
Yep. but I remember it was just, when did I move? It was right before I moved, actually. So James, my partner, was in San Francisco, because he had probably moved around August, and then I moved there on Thanksgiving. So I'd come up to visit him for Halloween, and went to the Castro, and it was just electric. All these weirdos just, like, crowding the streets, unofficially shutting everything down. You know, it wasn't like an official party by any means.
That's amazing. Oh God, I've only heard stories, but it sounds so cool.
I have this vivid memory of, like, standing up on, I can't remember which, oh no, it's on Castro Street. I was standing on Castro, just up the hill a little bit, like, just past the gas station, and, like, looking down into the Castro and seeing this huge throng of people. And there was, I want to say, I don't know if it was a phone booth or what. Like, I feel like 2002 was, like, too late for phone booths. But there was some structure. Maybe, I don't know, it was a utility box or something. And there was a guy up on top of it in a Spider-Man costume. And he was just, you know, kind of Spider-Manning and, like, posing and making gestures to the crowd. And, like, these cops are, like, gesturing and waving at him to get down and, like, trying to, like, persuade him down. And finally, a cop, like, climbed up on top next to the guy as he's posing. And the crowd's like, aw, and he made the Spider-Man guy get down. And then the cop was up there by himself. And the cop looks around at this crowd. And then the cop starts posing for photos.
That's amazing.
It was the kind of exciting and weird and lawless city that it was. And, you know, that stuff is still there. But it's, you know, like everything. It's not like it was. Because nothing, you know, everything changes. Nothing's ever like it was.
Yeah, everything will always change, but, you know, you make new, and there's new lawlessness that occurs.
Yeah, there is. So during that, like, war on fun era, there's this group that popped up called the San Francisco Party Party, and it was a political party that their only agenda, their only platform was throwing parties, but politically. So they would run people for office. I don't think any of them ever won, but they would run people for office who were trying to like make it easier to get permits and throw parties and have screenings and just do stuff. They, I remember they just took over Haight Street at one point and did like, they had just had like a soccer game the length of Haight Street, like all the way down the street.
Vertically? You know? Like not like, there was one goal at one end and another at the other, and they just had a soccer game?
That's how I remember it. Like there was like a goal at like Golden Gate Park, and then there was a goal like down in like Hayes Valley, and like they just worked their way all the way down.
Hayes Valley?
Yeah. That's, you know, and this is like 20 something years. It's not 20. It's like 10, 15 years ago. So who knows? But that's, yeah, my memory of like the things that made me feel like, okay, yeah, this is cool. I like this. This is a good place.
These are good people. That sounds very like the Pissed Off Voter Guide.
Oh, yeah.
The League of Pissed Off Voters, they're still here. But I've never heard of the Party Party. That sounds like a lot of fun.
That was a real blip. And there was a guy in like a chicken suit who would always follow Gavin Newsom around because I don't even remember what. He wouldn't like, oh, it was because of Question Time. They wanted him to like go and sit with the Board of Supervisors and answer like questions from the Board of Supervisors. And he wouldn't. So they followed him around with a chicken suit for a while.
Oh my God. I have to go to the Library Commission meetings, but I'll sometimes go to the supervisor meetings. They're so much fun. The way this city, like I come from Philadelphia where there's a lot of corruption and like things get done if you call the right person and it's all very quid pro quo. But in San Francisco, there's a hearing for everything and I love it so much.
I found it a little exhausting by the time I was done. I was like, can we just build these bike lanes, please?
Well, we finally have the bike lanes. So thank you for your advocacy.
I do what I can. There was this long period where the city had like an injunction against the bike lanes. They couldn't build anymore because they hadn't done the proper environmental review. And it took like 3 years to build a fucking bike lane.
Oh, so, my God. Ugh. Yeah. There's the tree commission. The Commission on San Francisco Trees is the city wants to get rid of these trees that are considered dangerous because their branches fall down. And they were very popular in the 90s. So the tree people want to not knock down any trees, even though they're called this thing public hazard. So the hearings are, they're fascinating. Everyone just wants a more perfect San Francisco, you know?
Yeah. Well, so what's your vision? Like, what is perfect San Francisco? What do you want to make the city?
Oh, it's pretty perfect for me right now.
Oh, that's great.
I mean, if it's like, I can only live here because I found rent control. So thank God for rent control. But I'd say making it a little more affordable, making it, a little, the bureaucracy, make it a little faster. But all in all, it's a pretty great city. It's the people here. It's kind of a challenge to live here, and it's hard sometimes. But the people who are here, they made it. And it's kind of like, you made it here. And that's, like, it's a certain, like, endurance that it takes. And you can see it in people.
Hmm.
Yeah.
When you look, like, at your time there so far, like, what do you see as having made it? Like, I know you've got, like, a group of friends and you're kind of finding your place. And I guess we should also talk about, like, professional stuff. And, like,
oh, yeah. It's very, you know, professional.
the work that you do that is fulfilling.
Oh, yeah, I definitely found my dream job, and it's really cool. I do the communications for the foundation that funds the San Francisco Public Library. So I'm their communications manager.
And I found Friends of the Library?
Yes, the Friends of the Library. And so it's a lot of just getting people excited about the library. We have a lot of events with authors that I get to see, and I got to meet these authors who I've been reading my whole life, and I met Joyce Carol Oates and was like shaking. I was so excited. She's a runner.
Oh,
I had
wow.
No clue. Yeah, she runs, speaking of high endurance, she like runs marathons, and apparently she runs throughout Princeton. You can see her running on campus.
That is so cool. I had no idea.
Yeah. Oh. And you see these great, like, I met Alexander Chi, which I think he's such a quintessential San Francisco, I mean, he's a New York writer, but his time in San Francisco is so cool, and his stories are awesome, and the writers you get to, did all these cool events with Tommy Orange. Yeah, I really fell into the job because I applied to a queer fellowship for the Hormel Center at the San Francisco Public Library. And it's one of the premier queer archives in the country. And I applied for the job and I had their interviews. And they were like, oh, actually, we're going to put your name into this to be this communications person. I totally did not have the qualifications. I'm like an English major from New Jersey, who's been working retail since I moved to San Francisco, and they hired me, and I've been there for a while.
Well, that's great, and I'm sure not at all what you expected when you moved to the city. Like you'd be a library gay.
No, not at all. And I didn't really expect anything. I just expected to move here and had no other expectations. So becoming a library gay was it's pretty fun. I'm along for the ride.
What, like, did you feel, I don't know, some surprise that's where you wound up? Were you like, I guess this is who I am now?
Yeah, kind of. It was surprising that they would even consider me.
Why is that?
Because I had gone on like hundreds of job interviews, and like I'd apply to every company in the city, and like nobody, I would get these interviews for the lowest level jobs and then still not get it. And I was like, how is this? Like, I look so good on paper. Like, I ran my own business throughout college. I ran like I have a great experience. I can build websites, which I did hear you mention that earlier, which really touched me. It's a really good skill to have. So I was just like, I had so much rejection and kind of just embraced it. So it was such a nice surprise to be considered.
Have you found that to be a particularly like queer space to be in?
Oh, everyone in my office is queer. Like, I wake up, everyone around me is queer. I go to my office, everyone's queer. I have meetings at the library. Not everyone, but most people are queer. Yeah, it's very queer.
I feel so privileged to be in like a similar place where I really feel like I'm living that, you know, that screen grab from OK Cupid where it's like, I don't want to see or be seen by heterosexuals.
Yes, I do know.
I just, you know, I feel like I'm applying that to my life. And I don't know. It's a nice feeling.
It is. And you don't know it until you start to feel it and see it. So you don't like. So do you work out of your home every day?
Yeah, yeah. So it's basically me and my partner are basically co-conspirators, and so we work on projects together.
And you guys have been together since San Francisco?
Yeah, we met around 2000, so it's kind of been a while.
Oh my god. I don't know what it is, but like, straight people can tell me about their relationships all they want, and I like won't feel a thing, but the minute I hear about beautiful, queer, lasting love, I just like get really teared up. That's so beautiful.
It's nice. It's real. And like, honestly, that's another thing I remember from San Francisco is when all the marriage equality stuff was happening, you'd see these couples at the rallies with these signs that were like, you know, together 24 years, or like it was crossed out like year over year over year that they'd been protesting. So you could see like together 15 years and 20 years and 25 years.
Wait, so you were here for the Gavin Newsom, like what the rumors I've heard are like Gavin Newsom doing cocaine in City Hall and signing marriage licenses?
Yeah, yeah. I wrote a book about that.
You wrote a book?
Yes.
Sorry, yeah. You're going to hear typing. I need to Google you more. And read your book.
Get my book, Defining Marriage, available now at definingmarriage.com. Yeah, so I remember vividly. There were two two Gavin Newsom bus rides that I really remember. One is the day that the news came out that he was having an affair with one of his staffers, or the wife of one of his staffers, or something like that. And I got on the bus, and I didn't know what had happened because Twitter didn't exist yet. And I just sit down, and I see everyone on the bus is reading a newspaper. And I'm like, oh, that's a little different. It, like, everyone is, like, on the same page of the San Francisco Chronicle. And I'm like, I wonder what happened. And then that news came out.
That is awesome.
But then the other one is like I worked downtown and I was taking the 5 down from like down Fulton and passed by City Hall and I could see the lines forming outside City Hall. And it was actually, I think the news came out first. So like we heard like it was Valentine's Day. Gavin Newsom has started marrying gay couples. What? And then within
that,
a day
like,
or two.
In the newspapers, in the bus, or did you hear that like on the TV?
I'm trying to remember. I think it must have been, like, I'm sure somebody emailed me or something like that, because that's how it worked. That would have been 2004, I think. And so I think I was writing for Esophist at that point. And I'm sure, like, the news came to us pretty quickly. And, you know, we started processing it and writing about it and being like, what? Really? Is this true? And then within a day or two, every time I rode by City Hall on the bus, I would see those lines. You know, no matter what the weather was, what was going on, there would always be a line around the block at City Hall of couples just waiting all day long to get married. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I can't wait to read your book. Oh, this is so cool.
So that happened, and then that lasted for a couple of weeks, and then that went away because I think there was a California Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. And, you know, it just turned into this whole battle that got us to Prop 8, and the Prop 8 got us to the Supreme Court, and then the Supreme Court finally happened. It took about 10 years from Gavin Newsom doing that thing. And, you know, he just, like Pete Buttigieg, his politics aren't necessarily my politics, but there's a lot of good in what he does.
Yeah, and that was a pretty good thing.
Yeah. It's been a while since I really, like, cast my mind. So I wrote this book maybe, like, 3 or 4 years ago, and, just casting my mind back to that reminds me again of why San Francisco is such an interesting organism. Like, it's constantly growing and changing and mutating, and, this is just one of those times when it certainly was that.
It was really, literally setting the agenda for the rest of the country.
It super was, yeah.
It's the best. It's such a fun place to live.
Yeah.
And local politics are just, I have such a thing for local politics, and here's the perfect place to live.
Oh, yeah, you'll never get your fill. There will always be more that you can have. Do you have any, like, projects on the horizon, or, like, stuff that you want to do? Like, we're recording this just at the start of 2020, so, like, I don't know, like, to put you on the spot and, like, ask you, like, for resolutions or whatever. But, like, what are the things that you haven't done yet as a San Francisco gay that you want to do?
Well, I did read Tales of the City once. So I do my New Year's resolutions in February, like Michael Mouse. I'm that kind of gay. So I don't have resolutions yet, but I definitely want to go into the sunset more. I feel like I've been there once, and it's a really cool neighborhood. I want to go figure out... there's a bar called Wildside West that's apparently a lesbian bar that I want to check out. And I don't know. 2020 is going to be a fun year. I have a couple friends who want to get together and kind of get the satirical newspaper we had in college back together. We'll see if that works out, but yeah. As far as on the horizon, I just want to, become more a part of San Francisco. I feel like I still feel sometimes like an outsider here. Mm. And I know people who've lived here for like 10 years and they say they still feel that way. But it's doing the small things to make you feel more a part of it. That's what I'll be doing.
Well, that's great. Yeah. It's an ongoing process. And, like, Tales of the City is a great, piece of culture to be your guide when it comes to finding your place.
Yeah.
I never really cared for how Marianne, like, it felt like she was very, like, scandalized by saying, like, she wanted it, but at the same time, she, like, kept the city at a distance. So
Yeah. I feel like it's that Godfather, was it Godfather 3 quote that they quote in The Sopranos all the time? It's like, just when I think I'm out, they pull me back in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let it pull you in. Let San Francisco pull you back in as deep as possible. Awesome. So if folks want to, you have a delightful Twitter presence. So if folks want to follow you, where should they go?
Thank you. Go to @MVDDM on Twitter and Instagram and pretty much everywhere else.
LinkedIn. Fantastic. Yay. Well, here is to a happy and successful 2020.
Oh, for you too. I can't wait to read your book, and I'll go rate it on Goodreads as well, because it Yay. Looks like it's going to be great.
Thank you so much. Well, and thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you. It's an honor.
Thanks again to Michael for joining me. For this week's recommendation, take a look at a documentary entitled The Untold Tales of Armistead Maupin. We talked a bit on this episode about Armistead Tales of the City novels, which feature a cast of characters finding themselves in a very different San Francisco starting the 1970s. The documentary pulls back the curtain on Armistead himself. It's a perfect primer on not just what his books are, but on why they matter and to whom they mattered most. Starting in the 70s, his stories of mingling singles in San Francisco were only supposed to be a fun weekly newspaper blurb. But as time went on and his subject matter got queerer, his columns became a lifeline for a community that still faced daily struggles to survive. Looking back nearly a half century later, it's hard to imagine what that world could even have been like when queer culture was taboo in San Francisco. So much of that history was lost to the epidemic, to bigotry, and to the fear, which was completely reasonable, that documenting LGBTQ lives would expose them to even greater harm. If you're of a certain age, you can rely on your memory to keep those distant voices alive. But for the rest of us, those records of the time, whether written down or shared face-to-face, are a vital link to those who built the world that we enjoy today. Thanks again for listening, and thanks to everyone supporting the Sewers of Paris on Patreon. Visit sewersofparis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon to join the folks who make the show possible and check out the rewards for backers. Thanks also to everyone who's reviewed The Sewers of Paris on your podcast platform of choice. And remember, our next brunchtime live stream is coming up on January 25th. There's a link at the top of The Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Please reach out, let me know what you think of the show on Twitter and Facebook or at sewerspodcast@gmail.com. And by the way, if you enjoy LGBTQ podcasts, you may enjoy my other show, Queens of Adventure, a comedy adventure podcast that stars drag queens playing Dungeons & Dragons. That's at queensofadventure.com. The theme song for the show is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Incomptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.